Welcome. This is Saturday Morning Live. My name is Mally, aka Docu Vixen, and this is Radio Regent, and we're heard here every Saturday, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., and we first go to Mamia Abu-Jamal.
Women and the movement. We meet today in the vast shadow of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and that is fitting. For much like his contemporary, Minister Malcolm X, he had the capacity to grow beyond his social, cultural, religious, and even class programming. But before we go deep, it is also fitting that we thank Drs. Tanisha Ford and Hakama Abbas, your forum co-chairs of this event, for their kind invitation. And to our fellow forum contributors, Dr. Johanna Fernandez, Alexis Pauline Gums, Christopher Tenson, Jamila Wilson, Walida Imarisha, Noel Hanrahan, The Cornel West Theory, Dr. Ruth Gilmore, and last, but certainly not least, Dr. Angela Davis and others to come. Thank you, too, to The Feminist Wire for covering this event. How does Dr. King's life inform our discussion of issues that we face today at the dawn of a new century? Issues as complex and diverse as the LGBT community's trek and treatment through the criminal justice system, black women, the nation's fastest growing prison population, social and systematic violence against black women and girls, the rape culture that permeates modern day America, or feminism as a social force which broadens our perspectives of the prison industrial complex. If King were alive today, he'd be 85 years old, but he is not. Yet his ideas deepened through the experience of movements, and perhaps more importantly, his inspiration remains. For the civil rights movement has had a profound impact on the nation, the world, and movements to come. But Martin, reared as he was in the bosom of a conservative, privileged, middle-class Baptist family, seemed ill-prepared for the topsy-turvy, hurly-burly struggles of the era, when blacks were compelled to struggle against their racial, class, gender, and national oppressions. Given his background of privilege, he found confident, outspoken activist women hard to take. This was perhaps best seen in his interactions with activist organizer Ella Baker. For let us be clear, like many, perhaps most men, King was sexist and chauvinistic. As a man of his class and his profession, he expected deference, especially from women. Ella Baker, a brilliant, skillful organizer, was unable to defer to any of the spiritual or national leaders of that time. She opposed on principle the idea of charismatic leadership, preferring instead for collective leaders drawn from their work among the people. She was among the founders of SCLC, or the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. She founded the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, called SNCC, and had traveled the country organizing as field secretary for the NAACP. In Baker's words, she knew she wouldn't make it among the ministers of SCLC, explaining, "There would never be any role for me in a leadership capacity with SCLC. Why? First, I'm a woman. Also, I'm not a minister. And second, I knew that my penchant for speaking honestly would not be well tolerated. The combination of the basic attitude of men, and especially ministers, as to what the role of women in these church setups is, that of taking orders, not providing leadership, and the ego problems involved in having to feel that there was someone who had more information about a lot of things than they possessed at the time, this would never have lent itself to my being a leader in the movement there." King felt uncomfortable around Baker and other women of her type. She had a saying, "Strong people don't need strong leaders." She also wasn't keen on building national organizations so much as she believed in building movements. King, as a man transformed by the burgeoning movement around him, tried mightily to adapt to it, but it wasn't easy. For, like many men, King had a weakness for female flesh. He felt guilty about it, yes, but he indulged, for he couldn't say no. In this conflict between flesh and spirit, flesh inevitably won out. Many of us associate Dr. King with his last big movement push, the Poor People's Campaign. When he accepted the invite of National Welfare Rights Organization Executive Director George Wiley to address their board, he experienced a rude awakening. For the NWRO board was staffed by women, and they felt offended because they had advanced the idea of a Poor People's Campaign before the SCLC had done. When King met with the board, they shocked him with their aggressiveness and their radical thinking. When King was given the floor, he stated his ideas and solicited their support. NWRO first vice chair, Etter Horn, asked him for his views on Public Law 90-248. King was dumbfounded. NWRO leader, Johnny Tillman, a woman, told King that Horn meant the anti-welfare bill, H.R. 12080. It was passed by Congress the year before, she said, and signed into law by President Lyndon Johnson in January 1967. King again had no clue. Tillman pressed her advantage, saying pointedly, "Where were you when we were down in Washington trying to get support for Senator Kennedy's amendment?" King, the leader of the movement, was really helpless before welfare mothers on top of their game. Johnny Tillman, seeing him and his staff getting defensive, said, "You know, Dr. King, if you don't know about these questions, you should say you don't know, and then we would go on with the meeting." King agreed, saying, "You're right, Mrs. Tillman. We don't know anything about welfare. We're here to learn." And he did. He listened. He learned. That learning reshaped, deepened, and broadened his ideas. He outgrew many of his earlier notions and became increasingly socialist in his economic orientation, anti-capitalist, and quite rare for the time among black civil rights leaders, deeply anti-war. While Martin, as preacher, might have brought women to church, it must also be said that women, as teachers, took him to school. For at the heart, at the very core of both church and the movement, were women. Their faith, their wisdom, their knowledge, their visions of a better tomorrow fed those expressions and gave them life. Martin's martyrdom may have ended his individual existence, but it did not still the movement, for movements spread, grow, deepen, and develop. The civil rights movement gave space and life to the black liberation movement, the women's movement, the Latino movement, the LGBT movement, and beyond. That's because those democratic energies could not be repressed forever. When King burst through, he opened doors that had been soldered shut in American society. One of the most radical of the black liberation groups to sprout in this post-King period was the Black Panther Party, founded 2 years before King's assassination by two college students. Although assuredly the BPP was weighted with a decidedly macho image, what with the berets, the black leather jackets, and, lest we forget, guns, it was most assuredly not an all-male collective. Indeed, quite the reverse is true. The BPP had a majority of female members, and a good number of women led local sections or even captaincies in cities. Indeed, the BPP was the only formation of the era to have a woman in complete command of the group under Elaine Brown. Was the Black Panther Party sexist? Yes, without question. But within a sexist society, who was not? If King, with all of his extraordinary education and gifts, was trapped within the dark amber of sexism, what of men who had no such learning, who learned from the streets? That said, the BPP leadership pronounced at this very time that it supported women's liberation and gay lib to boot. Party co-founder Huey P. Newton mused, "Maybe they might be the most oppressed people in society." Frankie Malika Adams from the Brooklyn chapter of the party said, "Women ran the BPP pretty much. I don't know how it got to be a male's party or thought of as a male's party." She knew what every male Panther knew, that despite what the newspapers reported, without women, who made sure the work got done every day, the organization would not have lasted as long nor did as well as it did. Period. Women form the core of movements. They organize, as did Ella Baker. They lead, as did Elaine Brown. They do the work to make organizations and movements work. And given the sexism extant in a capitalist society, it rarely gets reported, much less known. But the simple truth is that revolution is women's work and men's work. It is the work of all of us, working as comrades. Kathleen Cleaver was a member of SNCC, a group founded by Baker. She joined the party and is today a law professor working against the prison industrial complex. Safia Asia Bukhari was a college student who was intrigued by the party Breakfast for Children program. When she was threatened by cops, she quit college, joined the party, and later ran the party's East Coast organization from the Bronx headquarters. She later led and commanded units of the Black Liberation Army before she returned to the ancestors. Martin Luther King Jr. was made both literally and figuratively by women. They educated him, even when he didn't want to be educated. Again, as Baker stated, Martin didn't make the movement. The movement made Martin. Progressive and liberatory social movements are energized and sustained by the gifts women bring with them. They broaden our perspectives on issues of women, gender, and how, under capitalism, all within the prisons of capital are exploited, atomized, made to war against each other to preserve the rulers. Martin opened doors to rooms he did not know existed, but he did do so with a hope that it would lead to greater social justice and fairness. In one of his latter speeches before SCLC, King presented a synthesis of his ideas, calling for a radical restructuring of the entire system. We are called upon to help the discouraged beggars in life's marketplace. But one day, we must come to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. He continued this questioning openly in ways he had done so privately. Who owns the oil? Who owns the iron ore? Why is it that people have to pay water bills in a world that is two-thirds water? King of 1967 was a different man than that of 1965, a deeper man. Such a man as that would say this: a nation that would keep people in slavery for 244 years will thingify them, make them things. Therefore, they will exploit them, and poor people generally, economically. And the nation that will exploit will have to have foreign investments and will have to use its military might to protect them. All of these problems are tied together. It is a measure of some irony that King couldn't bring himself to work closer with one of the most talented organizers of the era, Ella Baker. For some 30 years before her career as a civil rights organizer bloomed, she co-wrote with colleague Marvell Cook a remarkable article published in the NAACP journal, The Crisis, which revealed the venal nature of capitalism for poor black women in Harlem. They wrote, "Not only is human labor bartered and sold for the slave wage, but human love is also a marketable commodity. Whether it is labor or love, the women arrive as early as 8 a.m. and remain as late as 1 p.m. or until they are hired. In rain or shine, hot or cold, they wait to work for 10, 15, and 20 cents an hour. This, the naked face of capitalism, where one sells their flesh to eat, was an insight that Baker knew, but it took a lifetime of King to glimpse. Capitalism eats its own, for there are no Chinese walls nor sacred barriers. It is buy and sell, money trading, as the highest value of life. It shows us all how far the movement has yet to go. I thank you. On the move. Long live John Africa. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal." Martin's song, His name is on millions of lips, in dozens of countries. His image, youthful, strong, and handsome, radiates from thousands of walls in black communities across the country. His voice, confident, softly couched in the accents and rhythms of the South, is instantly recognized as among the finest orators of the 20th century. I speak, of course, of Martin Luther King Jr. And although all of those things are so, it is also true that the man who is so well known is also so little known, for he was, too, a complex man, and Americans want simplicity, not complexity. He, as with all living, thinking beings, changed, developed, and deepened as life taught him lessons that schools could not. As ever, his Riverside speech is little known. But because of what he said at that church in New York City, his fair-weather friends, political allies, and doting media deserted him, denounced him, and left him open to the lonely death that stalked him. In the words of scholar, activist, historian, and theologian Dr. Vincent Harding, King was the inconvenient hero, for he was on a radical trajectory that inspired his Riverside speech, where he denounced militarism, corporate greed, political betrayal, and yes, capitalism. For this, he made few friends and grew numerous enemies. He, at Riverside, called war an enemy of the poor and a cruel manipulation of the poor. He, at Riverside, called for a revolution of values which would look across the seas and see individual capitalists of the West investing huge sums of money in Asia, Africa, and South America, only to take the profits out with no concern for the social betterment of the countries and say, this is not just. Or else, he warned, people would be demonstrating against foreign wars for generations. How right he was. That's not the King we see on TV, nor the one we hear on radio. That's not the man portrayed in movies. That, in Harding's words, would be inconvenient. But that was the man that was. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Obama's surveillance state. When an American president announces a speech on his intelligence agencies, eyes and ears tune in. That's especially since the Snowden revelations of NSA dishes receiving billions, billions of bits of information from Americans, foreigners, everybody. But that president, smart, smooth as Chinese silk, handsome, took the mic to try to calm the storm by giving privacy advocates and security agencies something to take home. Twitches here, tweaks there, and statements designed more to ease national anxieties than to actually shut down the surveillance state. When President Barack Obama said that the NSA doesn't tap phones except when serious national security threats are at stake, he frankly sounded more like his predecessor, George W. Bush, than he surely intended. For try as I might, I could not resist the recollection of Bush standing at the lectern, the presidential seal reflected in dozens of camera lenses, saying, the United States does not torture. For was German Chancellor Angela Merkel a national security threat? Were any other leaders? And by declaring no more tapping of phones of leaders, does that now mean second-tier leaders will be surveyed even more? It would seem so. The business of intelligence is intelligence. The business of spies is spying. As long as such agencies exist, that's what they'll do. Period. That's the real bottom line. And no president will dare to challenge such a powerful tool in his arsenal. Indeed, he or she would welcome it. Think of every U.S. president since Harry Truman, president when the CIA was established in 1947. Can you name one who didn't use the agency against his opponents or refused intelligence data? There are none to name. It matters little that Senator Obama was critical of U.S. intelligence when running for office. For once in, the game changed. It was his. Truman, once out of office, said he never wanted a cloak and dagger outfit, but out of office is out of power. And John Kennedy, embarrassed by the Bay of Pigs fiasco and failure in Cuba, reportedly told friends he wanted to break CIA into 1,000 pieces. He never lived long enough to do so. Obama, like every president before him, has fallen before the dream of intelligence, a dream that always promises much more than it can really deliver. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. It came without warning. I was talking to my wife, and all of a sudden, these alarms start going off. This was, or was supposed to be, the smoke alarm. And I assumed, wrongly, as it turned out, that, you know, someone had activated the sensor of the alarm by smoking in their cell. I heard something, but I discounted it. I saw people running, and it was like a lot of noise because these alarms are very, very loud. Lo and behold, after I finished talking to Wadia, I, you know, walked back to the back of the block. And I heard this rushing sound. Guys began explaining and screaming and banging on their doors because water started falling through the sprinkler system. And before long, it was coming out of the light circuits. It was coming from everywhere, especially in an area called the dorm, where about 7 or 8 guys, you know, sleep in a confined area. They were banging to open the door, and before you knew it, water was just everywhere. Every cell on the lower half of this block got some degree of water damage. I mean, it was just, you know, people were rushing to pick up their papers off the floor. I got some, but I didn't get all, and a good amount of mail and stuff like that got simply destroyed. It was exciting, but it wasn't that in a good way. It was something to experience. It was so much water, in fact, that water was running out of the front door of the entire block. Some guys had about 4 inches deep, some more. Some people lost typewriters because they were locked in their cell and pushing the button, and the guy at the desk was a rookie, and he was kind of afraid of opening people's doors. And it was interesting. And as I said, not in a good way. I apologize for anyone if I don't answer their mail right quickly, because I'm still trying to sort through stuff. But it was the great flood of 2014. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.